Hello, my name is Jay, and welcome to Highbrow Theater, a podcast where we analyze theater so you don't have to. In today's episode, I have brought along a very special friend to discuss a very important topic, especially right now. She's an actress for the stage and screen and an artist to the stars. She's also a part of a big surprise coming up with Highbrow Theater. Please welcome Elena. Hello, Elena.
Hello.
We haven't talked in so long, and this is so nice.
Oh, it's a breath of fresh air.
What have you been up to?
Oh, well, I just graduated into the pandemic purgatory. So major life changes. So that's how I'm only like 2 weeks out. So very much like in limbo, very much do not know what I'm doing. I was originally going to go to grad school in the fall, and then it was like they were like, give us $200,000, and I was like, no thanks. So now I'm not going to grad school in the fall. So
that is see, that's what, why are we expected? It's like graduate on a Sunday, Monday, you start your job. Like, that's not, just like, give me a second.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. Especially now. Are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it is very much, it is perhaps not the ideal time to graduate, but, you know, hey. What can you do?
I want to talk about how we met, because I honestly think, I think it was a star aligning moment.
I think so too.
It was just, wait, okay. So the show that we met as part of a production. However, I want to point out that one of my friends was assistant directing and sat in on the audition. And Elena, would you mind explaining what you auditioned with?
Yeah, so for that audition, I used I think it was called the Revolt Forecast from The Onion as my audition monologue. If you are not familiar, dear listeners, you simply must go to youtube.com and look it up. I'm sure you could find it if you search a few different terms, but basically, like, a weather forecaster starts talking about how, like, oh, there's a heat wave in New York City, and then just descends into a call for violent revolution. definitely my finest audition material, I would say.
She said you were the funniest out of all of the auditions, and she still talks about it, even though it was like 2.5 years ago.
Oh,
yes. We met in that show. I think our characters were the most opposite of each other, perhaps.
I think that's fair to say. I mean, they have some, Otto and Mrs. Rosemary, they had some overlap, I would say. You know, they're kind of traditional ladies, you know, they're a bit old school. Yeah, Mrs. Rosemary, she was Michael von Siebenberg's landlady, and she's just like, I don't know, she's a real go-getter. You know, she like comes in with like a meat cleaver in the last scene, like she's like ready to call the ops on Michael because she suspects there's something rotten in the Alamo. that's her.
Well, I guess we're both old because I was a Viking ghost from like the 1400s. So we got the age thing going on.
You were 600. I was like 80.
In the scheme of things, not that far apart.
Yeah.
So let us dive into today's topic, of which I just realized I have not mentioned. It is going to be disability and accessibility in theater. let's talk about what is disability, because I think that's an important point moving forward. So we're kind of all on the same page. The CDC, the Center for Disease Control, defines a disability as any condition of the body or mind, or an impairment, that makes it more difficult for the person with the condition to do certain activities, which is activity limitation, and interact with the world around them, and that's participation restrictions. Now, you know, with any medical terminology, there has to be a definition of sorts, so there's a reference point. But, you know, people are people, and there's what happens in one person, like two people could have the same thing and it affects them differently. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that that's a really good point in particular about like two people could have the same condition, but they could have completely different experiences. I think it's important for people to understand that like disabled is an umbrella term that covers a lot of different experiences and conditions. Like there's a lot of overlap, particularly when you're thinking about like the experience of ableism, quite frankly, but there really isn't a universal disabled experience.
Now, would you like to discuss your disabilities? Because I think that can also help center all this and help people know where you're coming from.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important for people to know, like, I guess in a way, like what qualifies you to speak on a topic in a way. At the most basic level, I identify as crippled because it denotes a very specific experience under the umbrella of disabled. When I say like I'm crippled, it's a reclamation, but it also very explicitly means physically disabled. That's like the, I don't know, that's like the forefront of my identity, like what impacts me the most, I think. And then I have a lot of comorbidities, which, you know, that just kind of happens when you are chronically ill or disabled. But the diagnoses that impact me the most are fibromyalgia, lupus, and ADHD. So a lot of times when I speak on my experience as a disabled person, it's coming from specifically my experience with those conditions. I also think it might be useful for people to know that I'm an ambulatory wheelchair user, meaning I don't always use my mobility aids. I, like, for instance, I might use a wheelchair or a cane when I'm having a flare-up or I'm in a situation where I know I'm going to need to walk or stand for a long time. I think there's like a common misconception that people who use mobility aids, particularly wheelchairs, need them all of the time, like need them 24/7, like even to use around the house. But that is not always the case. I guess I want like listeners to take away that like even if someone only uses a mobility aid sometimes, it doesn't mean that they're like faking their condition.
Yeah. What is that? You know what pisses me off is when people use the motorized carts in the grocery store, we were like, just get up and walk. I'm like, who gives a shit? Like,
oh my God.
What do you know? Oh my, I'm getting into this thing of just letting people live their lives. So I'm learning things that I'm like, ooh, I did that, didn't I?
Yeah, I think that also, like, I don't know, that impulse that some people have to, like, get angry at people using the motorized carts in the grocery store, for example. Like, that impulse they have stems from just, like, a misunderstanding of disability. I feel like that person doesn't look disabled, but disabled can look like many things, including like a young person. Mm-hmm. So And people don't necessarily think about that.
A lot of my disabilities are mental, and they're like, I'm just, I'm glad medication exists. We'll say that.
Oh, 100%.
Oh boy. Before I went to the doctor, and after I went to the doctor, I'm like, how on earth was I going day to day like this?
Oh gosh, I totally, yeah. Oof, life before, like, necessary medication and after.
Mm-hmm.
That's wild. Absolutely. The difference is, the contrast is mind-boggling.
I also want to point out that if you, the audience, are considering going to a mental health professional, getting checked out, it's okay if the first medication doesn't work. You know, like, you're not broken. It's just your body's different than that.
That's so true. Yeah.
Because, like, I had one that did not go well for me, and I'm like, well, I guess this is it. And then my doctor was like, no, there's this other one. It's like, oh, I see the light.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I've had that happen before where I get frustrated where, like, oh, like, we went up on dosage in this medication and it's not really, like, I don't really feel like a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, medication is supposed to, like, is, like, actually supposed to make you feel better.
Yeah.
And some, like, even as obvious as that sounds, sometimes I, like, forget that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one time I was talking to my doctor about like, symptoms that I was having and about, like, a medication that was supposed to manage those symptoms. And I was, like, I can, like, walk around and, like, kind of do what I need to do, but I can't do a dance routine or, like, go for a run or anything. And he was like, well, no, but I would like for you to be able to do those things. And I was like, dang, oh, he kind of went off. So, like, yeah,
that warms my heart, though.
Yeah, so yeah, it's okay to, there are many medications. It is okay to ask for, to just say that this one ain't working and ask for a new one.
Mm-hmm. Into the theatrical section of the pod, how have your disabilities impacted your theater going experience, like being in the physical theater space?
First of all, I think as an audience member, like, the first thing that comes to mind with this question is that, like, I have missed out on so many performances because I just know that I couldn't handle a 4-hour time commitment that evening. Like, for instance, like, if I'm already having a bad symptom day, there's always a risk, a pretty large risk, that it'll just get worse if I decide to go to the show and I'll just be debilitated the day afterwards. Also, like, theater goes, like, really late into the night, and that is, like, if you're, like, chronically ill, you know that, like, sleep schedules are very important for kind of maintaining any sense of normalcy. So sometimes I'm just like, I cannot be in a black box until 11:30 p.m. tonight, man. Like, that just,
yeah.
Like, I've got stuff to do tomorrow. I cannot just be out. This is different, like, in the plague world. But, like, I get really anxious and can quite easily experience, like, sensory overload if I'm in, like, a small crowded space, like a full black box theater where you're kind of, like, shoulder to shoulder. I don't know. I end up being kind of unable to enjoy the performance or comprehend the play at all sometimes.
My attention issues make it difficult to exist as an audience member because I never feel like I have a full grasp on what happened. There will be holes in my memory of trying to go back and be like, but how did they get there? There will be an audience member who does something, or I'll be very aware that I'm watching a play, or I'll be staring at the set for 10 minutes. You're like, oh yeah, I gotta watch other things. And I have my sitting down skills. It's not skills. My sitting down abilities are not great. Like, I cannot sit still for the life of me. Like, I'm sitting in a desk chair right now, and I, like, haven't stopped moving back and forth.
I relate to that big time.
What would you like to change in regard to being in the physical space?
Well, we have been approaching this with our talk of, like, attention and ability to sit for extended periods of time. But I don't think it's controversial to say that theater takes too long. It takes too long. If the play is like 2 hours, you probably at least have like a 3 to 4 hour time commitment, because you have to go there, you have to, you know, wait for it to start. There's an intermission. An intermission isn't like necessarily guaranteed at all performances. Mm-hmm. And I think that like having shorter performances benefits everyone, not even just necessarily people in the disabled community. I think if you're sitting there for a shorter period of time, you're going to comprehend the play better afterwards. You're not gonna get that kind of, I don't know if there's a proper term for this, but you're not gonna get like fatigued from having to like extend your focus for that long. Pregnant people go to plays and like you can't. Gosh, I've never been pregnant, but like it messes with your bladder and stuff. You can't just be sitting like without getting up and leaving for like a full hour and a half. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a whole host of like people that would benefit from theater being shorter. I really don't think there's any reason to put on a full unedited production of like a Midsummer Night's Dream. That play is like 6 freaking hours long. That's excessive. Yeah, so the seats in a standard theater are usually like way too small and way too close together, which is not only an accessibility issue, but a public health issue and a fat phobia issue. Yeah, you made a good point. The accessible section in any given theater is usually like 2 seats in, yeah, the very front or the very back, or like awkwardly on the sides. So also I feel like accessible seating in theaters doesn't often take into consideration that you are at sitting height. If you are like in a wheelchair and you need to sit in an accessible, I don't know, I've been in accessible seating areas where I'm like, okay, clearly they designed this with like a standing person in mind, because I can't see crap. Also, okay, this is a good thing. I have seen increasingly more theater companies advertising like sensory processing disorder friendly performances, and I would like more of those, please. I think that's such a wonderful thing to normalize. And I'm sure we'll get back to this later, but we need to keep hybrid options available post-pandemic. I think the awesome thing about having like a virtual options available for your show is that not only is it more financially accessible, but it's more accessible to people who are maybe hard of hearing, because you can very easily, with like quite little effort, provide closed captioning and transcripts and things like that virtually. Yeah, lots of people can view your production who wouldn't otherwise be able to when you have virtual options. I know a lot of us, myself included, are getting really fed up with like Zoom theater. I think it's really necessary to like utilize things like Twitch and YouTube, or Vimeo maybe, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really important that we continue offering those things post pandemic. And also, like, I think from a theater making perspective, I feel like it is a lot less labor intensive and a lot less expensive to simply make a performance available virtually, like with captions and whatnot, than it is to like provide an interpreter or provide various like sensory friendly performances. Not to detract that I want more sensory friendly performances, but I'm just saying, like, if you don't have the resources to make that happen, you can make your performance available virtually with no budget and like very little effort.
Going off of sensory friendly performances, my mom works in the public school system, specifically in she referred to it as the intervention for students with multiple disabilities classroom. And she told me a story about a sensory friendly screening they went to of Angry Birds, the movie. And she had to, you know, take people in and out depending on what they needed at the time. And I'm like, people should just be able to do that, you know, like people have needs.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's definitely this, like, I don't know if stigma is the appropriate word, but there is a kind of stigma within the theater community of like getting up from a performance is like a cardinal sin. They'll be like, oh my god, that audience member got up and left. And like, also, they frequently will not let you go back in if you have to leave in the middle of a performance, which I think, I mean, like, I understand, because having had experience as a performer, I understand that that's distracting. But I think we need to prioritize people's needs, like physical needs, physical and emotional needs, rather than, I don't know, the luxury of the actor, I guess.
She also said part of the curriculum is teaching the students how to both interpret and express emotions, which I think that's like theater, you know, not
absolutely
like performance, but that's like a huge chunk of kind of the whole thing, which is why I think at our alma mater, we had a class called Shakespeare and Autism, which I think is really cool because it's kind of giving a sense of structure and also allowing them to express themselves freely.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a great benefit to like studying theater specifically with that intent in mind. I don't know. It helps. I mean, I think theater has helped me to like better understand like other people and why they do what they do and be a more like empathetic human.
Now, in the performing aspect, do you have any limitations as a performer and not having accommodations that you needed?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like, I mean, as a disabled person in general, but particularly as a disabled performer, I have been forced to master the skill of self-advocacy from a young age. I think able-bodied actors are afforded this like luxury of privacy that disabled performers simply do not get, because we always have to like bare our souls in order to like justify a kind of our requests for accommodations. It's part of this like fight to be seen as like reliable and hardworking and trustworthy. Because like particularly if you're chronically ill like I am, you are simply, you're frankly more susceptible to like missing rehearsals or even missing performances because chronic illnesses have no schedule. And I think that often leads to this misperception from directors or teachers or other performers even, that disabled actors are, they're like lazy and unreliable, like they're flaky because, oh, they missed another rehearsal, when it's really not their fault. So like what stands out in my mind is just like, I always have to work twice as hard as like able-bodied counterparts to kind of prove myself and like offset that that like perception from forming in people's minds.
Now, what would you like to see change in the performance world? Because I think that some directors claim a sense of ownership over the actor as a person and not their character. We are working together. I don't work for you. You know what I mean? There needs to be at least a little leeway there.
Yeah, that ties into something that I was thinking about, which was theater is not immune to toxic hustle culture, which I hope everyone knows what I'm talking about. But yeah, I think, I don't know, there's just this like hyper capitalistic mindset of like, I don't know, like if you work the hardest and you put in more hours than everyone else, and you take jobs for no pay, then you'll end up on top and whatever. Yeah, I don't know. The director ends up almost like a middle management type boss in that regard, where they're like, well, why can't you be available 24/7 to rehearse for our theater? I don't know. Like, I think theater in general just needs to be more holistic and more collaborative. I mean, it is inherently collaborative, but I think more people need to see it that way. Part of why I love devised work so much, because you are kind of forced into that. The playing field is very much leveled in that setting. I think it's one of those things again that like everyone can benefit from if like accessibility measures become more standard and built in, and people just have like an awareness of maybe of like symptoms or like the disabled experience in general. I think maybe that would help form a solution to this issue of like never getting to stop coming out as a disabled person. I think it might help eliminate some of that exhausting self-advocacy that we have to do constantly and over. I think disabled performers might get the opportunity to like relax a little bit and regain a bit of like autonomy and privacy.
I do want to ask, if you were the president of theater, you were Ms. Theater herself, how would you handle this era of pandemic theater? If somebody said, hey, this is getting bad, what do we do?
Well, I think like ultimately my largest goal and my largest hope is that there be more seats at the metaphorical table for disabled people. And I want the opportunity to, like, if especially if I were the president of theater, I would want the opportunity to have to hear from a diverse array of disabled experiences, because like I said, like we were talking about earlier, no two disabled experiences are the same, really. There's no universal disabled experiences, and so that you can't just have like one disabled advisor for that reason. Yeah, but like ultimately as a result of the pandemic, I hope that we keep virtual options. And I want I hope people understand that like making a commitment to accessibility benefits everyone, not just the disabled community. Like, for example, making your show available online makes it more financially accessible. It likely lowers the cost of the admission tickets, but even if not, it eliminates the need to pay for travel or gas and lodging just to see a show. And I think overall that contributes to like the de-stratification of theater. Like before the pandemic, I think I saw the mainstream theater industry, things like Broadway and the West End, got a lot of criticism, a lot of like think pieces for basically being a rich people only club. And in a lot of ways, it is a rich people only club. It's a rich, white, straight, cis, able-bodied, people only club. And I think that's one of the changes that we can make, aside from just making more room at the table for marginalized people. That's one of the changes that we can make to make it less of a rich people's only club in the long run. We can make it more inclusive and more accessible.
Speaking of inclusivity, let us move on to representation.
Yeah, so, there's not a lot of like disability shows, and then like the instances that we do have are not super great, at least in the mainstream.
Oh yeah, would you mind expanding on that, like what shows do and don't work great?
Oh yeah, sure. We can start on a positive note. One of my favorite plays is Teenage Dick by Mike Liu. Which, if you have not heard of it, is basically a retelling of Shakespeare's Richard III set in a 21st century American high school. And it was commissioned specifically to illuminate the disabled experience, and explicitly like states in the author's notes that disabled actors are to be cast in it. And speaking of Richard III, great segue into like a bad representation. Richard III is like the most famous canonically disabled character in like the mainstream theater, which like even I hadn't thought about until like this year, even. I think it's important to acknowledge that like Richard III is like this cartoon villain who happens to have a hunchback, and that kind of characterization contributes to the villainizing and othering of disabled people, which I would argue is more common in like film and TV, especially like the horror genre. But nevertheless, I want to see only disabled actors cast as Richard III when it is produced, period. There is no I don't know, if you're producing that show, it's important to like have that conversation of like, hey, this makes disabled people look really not great. Yeah, another like really prominent like play that has to do with disability is Cost of Living, which like won the Pulitzer for drama a couple years ago. The playwright is not disabled, nor is she like a caregiver for a disabled person, so I feel a little meh about that, like particularly about like an able-bodied playwright getting recognition, a Pulitzer Prize for disabled suffering on stage. But I admittedly have not seen or read Cost of Living, so I can't speak to like its merits as a piece of theater.
Yeah, there was a review of Cost of Living that said it would be a mistake to see Cost of Living as an identity play about people with disabilities. Rather, it's a play about disabilities with people. In both of its stories, which eventually collide, the biggest handicaps are the universal ones, fear and disconnection. I think that's stupid, but
Yeah, that is like very poorly worded.
I do think it is important. It is an important distinction of, I guess this goes back to it affecting everyone differently, of talking about the disability itself and how it interacts with people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not like I am not like a puritanical, like, you cannot have disabled characters in your play if you are not a disabled playwright. Like, how dare you? But I don't know. It is very delicate and nuanced.
There's the playwright section, but on the acting section, do you think that someone without a disability should or could portray someone with?
The short answer is no, but it is complicated because there are some rare situations where it is necessary that like an able-bodied person plays a disabled character. Ultimately, though, I think like if you are a director or a producer or you're just like casting a production and you have a disabled character in your play, you have an obligation to seek out disabled actors. And if you know going into it that you can't make that happen, pick a different play. Like, period. There's just no excuse. And also like disabled actors are out there. We just usually don't have access to the same opportunities as able-bodied actors. You know, we It's harder, it might be harder for us to like maintain an equity card, for instance. We don't necessarily have the same access to like education and training, particularly in musical theater. If you really want to put on a play with disabled characters in it, you should just put in the work to make sure that you have a pool of disabled performers. Back to the it's complicated part. I think this line from the National Disability Theatre's website is pretty on point, in regards to like casting disabled roles. They say, when circumstances require disabled roles to be played by non-disabled actors, casting Black, Brown, trans, queer, and gender non-conforming people disrupts the dominant narrative and challenges the perceived whiteness of disability in media. I think, yeah, enough said. There's lots of different facets to this like question of representation, but I think like ultimately the solution is just to have more disabled people in the theater overall, in all roles, actors, directors, designers, dramaturgs, playwrights, etc., etc. Yeah, you'll have the benefit of their perspectives. So you're not like tokenizing someone. That's like really the number one thing. Is I just want to see more. I want to see more disabled people be able to break into theater and thrive and be successful, because we really do not have a lot of them at all.
Well, I think that about wraps up our time here.
Ooh.
I want to thank you so much for joining, Elena. Where can people find you online?
You can find me on most platforms at Botticelli Barbie. I'm on.
So funny.
Yeah, that me. Yeah, I'm on Instagram, YouTube. I have like a blog on Tumblr where I kind of consolidate all my stuff. So that's a good place to check. Yeah.
Great. Well, if you would like to keep up with Highbrow Theater, we are on Twitter at Highbrow Theater. We also have a Patreon. So if you search Highbrow Theater in Patreon, you will be able to see all of the wonderful benefits that you may take part in. Thank you so much again, Elena. Bye.
Bye. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
Bye-bye.